Hanukkah. We're all very excited, right? Everyone excited? Hanukkah. Excited? It's an age-old question, which the rabbis have debated for many centuries. I don't know. I've probably seen seven variations or something. Yeah. 1K, 2K, CH, H, H at the end, OH at the end, you know, all sorts of things. But Hanukkah's tonight, so I want to discuss Hanukkah. Last week we actually began touching upon Hanukkah a little bit at the end of last week's class, and I told you I would expand upon the idea we mentioned then. Just to, I guess, recap, the idea we mentioned at the end of last week, we compared and contrasted the level of sanctity of a regular Kohen versus the Kohen Gadol, versus the High Priest. And in short, we had said that Kohen Gadol is somebody who lives kind of out of our world. We understand that there's certain rules and regulations within our world, in terms of science, math, philosophy, things which are rational in our minds, and there's something which is beyond our world. There's things which are in the spiritual, godly realm, which kind of transcend, supersede, and define our world. And these two things, they coexist, but the Kohen Gadol lives more in the spiritual plane, and the real Kohen lives more in the physical plane. That's kind of what we touched on last week. So this week I wanted to kind of bring out the idea a little bit more and discuss in Kaddish of Hanukkah. The Hanukkah, we know, is the holiday of light. You know, in modern Israel, it's commonly called Chag HaUrim, the festival of light. That's what they call it in modern Israel. But it's the festival, obviously it's based on the idea of light, because it's the time where we celebrate the miracle of the menorah being lit in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, finding that lost jug of oil, and being able to kindle the menorah, which otherwise could not have been lit, to do that mitzvah in the temple itself. Our mitzvah on Hanukkah, the way we observe Hanukkah, is through lighting the candles as well. And, you know, there's a common practice that you wish each other in Yiddish, a lichtig in Hanukkah, you should have a bright Hanukkah. Your Hanukkah should be lichtig. In Yiddish, lichtig is like light. It should be, you should have a bright Hanukkah, because our Hanukkah should all be bright and illuminated. So the focus of Hanukkah is light, is flames, is brightness. So I want to address a little bit what this means to us. And I think I point out before every single holiday, a lot of us, we observe Jewish holidays with the same understanding we had from when we were 6 years old. And the problem is that those understandings, they're true, but usually they're true. But they're very childish, very shallow. And a holiday goes much deeper and much further. So I think we all have to understand that especially I think Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a holiday which I think is misunderstood. I mention every year that the heroes of Hanukkah, the Hashmonaim family, the Maccabees, they're held up to be these incredible warriors with tremendous military savvy, were able to fight and overpower the enemies, where in truth the rabbis described them as weak, as few. They were righteous people who God helped overcome the enemy. They weren't great warriors. They weren't trained, you know, military fighters. They're held up, you know, maybe the Israeli Olympics referred to as the Maccabiah Games based on the Maccabees, and really I think it's a misnomer, because the Maccabees were not known to be these great athletes and these strong warriors. They're known to be righteous Torah scholars who God helped to defend defend the Torah and promote the Torah. In the prayers we say it is Giborim Biyad Chalashim. They're the mighty in the hands of the weak. We refer to them as weak. They're weak people. But yet, they were righteous people with God's help. So I think that we have to make sure we get that image out of our heads. That's number one. But even beyond that, there's a lot more to Hanukkah than meets the eye. We have to understand some of the deeper ideas of Hanukkah. So I want to try to develop an idea based on the first chapter in the Torah itself. And as I mentioned last week, we have to view the battle of Hanukkah. When the rabbis institute a holiday, Hanukkah's rabbinic. When the rabbis institute a holiday, the rabbis aren't just marking a one-time victory. You know, the classic, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. So, I mean, there's definitely truth to that on some level. But the rabbis saw something much, when rabbis actually, this is going to be a holiday for all generations, they saw something much deeper here than just one battle. And the Jews, unfortunately, many times in history, have been attacked. Thank God we have overpowered the enemies many times. We've experienced miracles as well. But the rabbis chose this to be the miracle to mark for generations. They saw something deeper here. And the way it's described in rabbinic sources and later sources is that this battle was not just one battle on the battleground, the Greeks versus the Jews. Rather, it was kind of an epic clash of Jewish culture versus Greek culture. And I want to try to look into that idea a little bit, how that relates to the story of Hanukkah and how that relates to the idea of lights and of lighting candles. So if you look at the very first chapter in Bereishis, The Torah records that, you know, Bereishis bara Elokim, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The world was, they say, void and empty, was confused, and there was darkness on the face of the depths. And the Spirit of God hovered over the water. So the second verse in the entire Torah describes the world as darkness. The world was dark. So what happened? God saw the world was dark. And then God said, the next verse, God said there should be light. And there was light. And then it says that God saw the light, and that it was good. And he separated between the light and the darkness. Just to complete the first day of creation, it then says, God called the light day, and he called the darkness night. It was evening, it was morning, the first day. So the first day of creation began with the world in darkness, and God then provided light for the world. Now Rashi has a very interesting comment on this concept of differentiating between the light and the darkness. Rashi says, what happened, and this is a famous idea discussed in the Talmud and other sources, Rashi said that when God first created the world and created light, that light wasn't light that we're used to. It was a different kind of light. That light was light which God saw was the wicked people who are going to live in this world are unworthy of using, and he stored that light away. And the light that we have nowadays is a different kind of light. That's what Rashi says. So when it says that God differentiated between the light and the darkness, Rashi tells us it means that God stored away this very special light he created for the use of the righteous in the world to come. And what remains in our world is a different kind of light. Now it is interesting that on the first day of creation there was no sun, so there couldn't be light of the sun. It's some other form of light. The sun was created on the fourth day. But whatever light was described, Rashi says, again based on the Talmud and based on other sources as well, that this light was a very special light that was stored away, and the light that we have is a different type of light. So Rashi understands that light on two levels. There's physical light, which we have, we can see each other in physical light, and there's some form of spiritual light which is hidden away, which we don't have any, that we don't get to use nowadays. This is based in the Talmud, in the Gemara says, in Tractate Chagiga, Gemara says that the light of the first day of creation was a very special light. You can see from one end of the world to the other with this light. So you could sit right here and you could see all the other end of the world. That's what it says. Yeah.
Why did he deprive us from this light before the sin, the original sin?
So it's a good question. We'll talk about that a little. Then we'll talk about that a little bit. We have to describe what this light is first.
And
right?
Also, when you say no sun, no light, for God, this problem can be resolved.
Oh yeah, that's not my point. My point is that obviously the light was not the light that we're used to. That's all I'm pointing out. It's not a problem for God to make light without sun, but saying we're used to light coming from sun, from fire, from light bulbs. You know, this is the light that came from none of those things.
Same. Actually, it also say, how can photosynthesis take place without the sun?
Right, not a problem.
God can do everything.
Right, correct. Fine. So the Gemara tells us this light was something you could use to see from one end of the world to the other end of the world. Now, I don't believe that means something physical. I don't know if it means like some super-powered binoculars or something. It means there was some perception that we had through this light that allowed us to understand the world to its fullest. So let's look at... nobody was there that would have allowed the human being, right, to understand the world to its fullest. Nobody was around to use that light at that moment, but that light was stored away. But this light was a very special kind of light. Right. The first day there weren't any beings besides God. Only second day were the angels created even. So nobody at that point got to use this light, but it was a light that gave a very special perception. Now, in general, light is what allows us to see. You know, we see each other through the light. So I think scientifically, all we're seeing is light bouncing off of things. That's all we really see scientifically. It's all about vision is light. Even in modern English, when we talk about, I see the light, that means I understand something. It's a perception that we have. You know, and I tell you, I see what you're saying. I don't see it, but I understand what you're saying. I mean, there's a certain metaphor of light, which means perception, understanding. Something has come to light. You know, I see the light. These are all forms of understanding. So when God created this special light that was hidden away, that allowed us to understand the world from one end of the world to the other, so seemingly, on a metaphoric level, it means that it was a light which allowed us to have complete understanding of this world. And that light was stored away, and we're stuck with the regular light that only allows us to see so much in front of us, and which can mean also our perception is limited based on the light that we have nowadays. So you had this darkness, God created light, And then the Torah tells us that this light isn't the light that we're thinking of. It's another kind of light. God stored it away, and now he put in the normal light in our worlds. So let's start again now. I'm going to go through one more time what it might mean. So again, the Torah tells us there was darkness at the beginning of creation. And if we want to use it in the metaphoric sense, so that darkness means that there was a lack of clarity, a lack of perception. This world was a very confusing place. It was a place where there was, we were in the dark. As we say as well, I'm in the dark. I don't understand this. I'm in the dark. I mean, the terms still apply nowadays. It's not just the Torah's way of speaking. What does it mean the world was in the dark? So many sources point out, and I think it's fairly rational, which is that when God created the world, God had to create some form of a cover, of a veil over the truth. Why is that? God wants to create a world with free choice. You have free choice. If God created a world and everything was clear, we could perceive God with clarity, with full understanding, and we see exactly how the world works, how God functions, how everything exists in this world, so we have no more free choice because we see God right in front of our face. We can't choose to do wrong. So God has to create a world where he conceals himself to some degree. However, if he conceals himself too much, we'll never find the truth. There has to be a balance. The balance is that God is concealed, but only enough that we don't see him in any obvious sense. But if we look, we can find God. So God created the world. The truth is something which is there and accessible, but not apparent. If you do a little work, a little research, you think, you study, then you can discover truth. But truth is something which jumps out in our faces. Truth is something which is concealed to some degree, but yet accessible. The word in Hebrew for world is olam, which is the same root as helam, which means something concealed, hiddenness. The world is a place of hiddenness. Helam is when one forgets, when something is concealed. So the world conceals its source. The Talmud tells us that this world is actually compared to the darkness of night. The verse says in Psalms, Tashis Choshech V'Laila, that the darkness fell and became night. And the Talmud tells us that refers to our world, which is compared to the night. So our world is compared to the darkness of night. Why is our world a world of darkness? Because it's a world where things are not so clear to us all the time. You know, it's an intellectual darkness. It's a perception that we're missing. Because the world conceals its source. And that allows the human being to ignore God or forget God or go against God. We see the world as something which is kind of self-sustaining. We see the world as something which seems to us as if it was here forever. You know, even though science might find a certain point where they feel that life began or the world began to some degree, we can't explain eternity. We can't explain where that first particle came from. And we kind of see the world as something which is kind of here, independent, self-sustaining, and removed from God in some sense. We can see it that way.
This one is called Simsum.
Simsum. Yeah, I think that
Yiddish-speaking people.
Right. Well, Simsum is a Hebrew term, but it's a Kabbalistic term. It's a Hebrew term. Yeah, Simsum is the idea where God has to kind of withdraw or retract himself to allow for a world to exist. Because else everything would be subsumed in God's greatness. So this world then, it begins in darkness in that there is a veil put over the truth. And things are not so clear to us. But God then, what does God do then? God then creates light. And so it's as if this world was dark and covered in a veil of darkness, things were unclear, and God flips on the light switch. So the light switch is flipped on, now you can see what's in the room. When the room is dark, you don't know what's around you. You don't see the truth in front of you. When you flip on the light switch, suddenly you can see what's there. So God says, Vayhi Or, let there be light. And God says, look at me, I'm here. Look a little deeper, you'll find what's behind the scenes. So the world has light in it. And the world has the ability then to perceive God and to find God in this world. So we have to understand that there is a veil of darkness, which is there in the creation of the world. But God provides light so that we can all find him and see the truth. And this, again, there was a darkness with physical, with real light. There's also a metaphor. There's also a concept of a world of confusion, and a world of unclarity, and a world of perception, a world of clarity. So there was a special light God created, which we said God hid away. And this was the light which gave us the full perception of the truth. It was a way to truly understand the world, to see beyond the world, to see God, to connect to God. And that was a light which was reserved and put away, which we'll talk more about what that means. But then we're left with a more faint form of light, a smaller form of light, which gives us the ability to see and perceive, but not quite the same. And God's difficult to find sometimes, and the truth is hard to find, and we have to do our efforts, and we have to study, and we have to think, and we have to analyze. Eventually, we can also come to the truth, even within this world of concealment. So now I'm going to go back one more time to the creation of darkness and light. Because then I want to use it on another level of metaphor. The Torah said again that the land was full of confusion and emptiness, and there was darkness. So the rabbis tell us, which I think I mentioned in previous years about Hanukkah, the rabbis tell us this verse refers to the four different forces which come up against Jewish people within history. We have a concept called the four Malchios. There's these four empires, which are kind of the antithesis of what Jews stand for. It's our arch enemies. Four empires are referred to. It's not clear. There's different opinions about what the four are, but the typical understanding of the four is Babylonia, which destroyed the first temple. Persia and Media, which go together, which there, that was the story of Purim, where Haman rose up to kill the entire Jewish people. They actually took the throne from Babylonia during that period of exile. Next is Yavan, is Greece, which is the story of Hanukkah. And fourth is Edom, Rome, which destroyed the second temple, and we still suffer from that exile to this very day. So those are classically the four kingdoms, the four empires that are referred to as the enemies, as the antithesis of the Jewish people. So the rabbis tell us that this verse, the second verse in the Torah, actually alludes to these four different forces. Because there was tohu, there was a void, and there was vohu, and there was emptiness. There was choshech, there was darkness, and there was asum, there was the depths. There was, you know, the endless pit, the bottomless pit. And those four terms actually allude to the four different empires. Now the term that alludes to Greece, which is the story of Hanukkah, is choshech, is darkness. Greece is called darkness by the rabbis. They're an empire of darkness. So going back to our understanding and our metaphor, why we look at it as Greece, it was darkness. I mean, we would think that Greek culture was actually a light brought to the world. We understand that much of modern thoughts, of modern science, of modern philosophy, modern architecture, modern culture is based on ancient Greece. I mean, that was really the first breakthrough into modern times was the ancient Greek world. And that got passed on from Greece through Rome all the way to this very day. And I'm sure much of American culture could be an American thought could somehow be attributed back to ancient Greece. I think that's probably something that we could say with confidence. So why are we referred to Greece as darkness? And like I said, darkness is a form of concealment. It's a form of concealment. So what do they stand for? And this is what we mentioned last week in short. We'll try to elaborate on. What does ancient Greece stand for? Ancient Yavon, ancient Greece, what do they stand for? So in our minds, we understand this is the source of philosophy, you know, Aristotle and the like, science, mathematics, architecture, you know, all these things really had their roots in ancient Greece.
And hedonism.
And hedonism as well, correct? You know, it's also there. The human body, they took the human body and held it up to be something. That's the ancient Olympics coming from Greece. You know, where they originated was done in the nude, because they held up the human body as something of great significance. But all these find their source in ancient Greece. And where did it come from? You know, Alexander the Great was the one who seemed to have spread this culture, these ideas, to the greater world, you know, during his conquest of the world. And that's where the story of Hanukkah really began, as Jews became Hellenized. Jews became very, very sucked into Greek culture, because it was very tempting. There was a beauty, there was intellectual stimulation, there was something about Greek culture that was very, very appealing to Jews. But they excelled in understanding the world, and Jews respect knowledge, we respect wisdom, we respect science. You know, Jews are, you know, the percentage of Nobel Prize winners that are Jewish is, you know, an incredible percentage. We very much respect and appreciate and strive to know and understand. But what's the problem with Greek, the Greek style of thought in terms of Jewish culture?
There
are too many gods. But putting aside the idolatrous aspect of it, I mean, all these nations were idolatrous at that point. But there was something else. I mean, the Romans had thousands of gods. They all had thousands of gods. You know, everyone had that. But what they excelled in, as we pointed out, the world has this veil of darkness upon it, and God hiding behind that veil of darkness. What's the veil of darkness in this world? Why do we think the world can run without a god? It's because we understand that there's science, there's mathematics. Things can work based on equations and numbers, and they're logical, and they're rational. You know, we have ways of explaining everything in this world. And we can explain many, many, almost every phenomenon that we're aware of. And the science has some way to explain theories, laws. Everything has its equation, everything has its mathematical formula. That's how this world works. And that's what really allows us to see this world as something which is separate from God, and not run by God. Because, you know, the world seems to run itself. It takes care of itself. Everything seems to just fit in and work and, you know, and function.
Yeah, but who produce these laws?
You're right, but that takes another step of thought. You're right.
Go back to the source.
But what did ancient Greece say? Ancient Greece said that everything has to be understood rationally. And I've pointed out before, even as you point out, they had many, many pagan deities. They worshipped many, many gods. In Greek mythology, something that's still well read for some reason. But all those gods were humans. They're basically superhuman. They're humans, but specific Superman. You know, they were humans. They were described as humans. They had human flaws and they had human desires and human passions. They just happened to be powerful, because they everything had to fit into the mind. It had to be rational. They couldn't understand things which are beyond their mind to understand. What's my point? They focused on the veil of darkness. The world of science, of math, these things are very significant for us to understand. But that's the veil which covers up God, because that's what allows us to think there's something else that the world can run on its own without God. That's what that cloak of darkness makes us feel. And they excelled. They were at the top in analyzing, understanding that cloak of darkness, but they could not look beneath the darkness. They couldn't find what's behind it all. So they could tell us everything. The Nachmanides, the Ramban, describes Aristotle. And he says that Aristotle is somebody who, whatever his mind can understand, he feels is true. If his mind can understand it, it can't be true. That's what Nachmanides writes, which, you know, that's where it's all coming from. You know, that's the thing. Everything has to be rational. It has to fit our mind, our process in our mind. And it has to be something which we can somehow put into a test tube. We can make a logical equation. We can somehow have a mathematical formula to fit it. But if I can't do that, if it's not rational to me, it can't exist. It can't be true. And that's the way that Aristotle was described by Nachmanides. And I think that's what we see in, you know, the whole culture of science is that. I mean, which makes sense. It has to be that way. That's how science works. It has to be tested and proven. Well, I don't mean the people. I mean science. I don't mean the scientists. You know, I'm saying you have many scientists who are very religious, but they understand there's science and there's God, and, you know. Absolutely, you know, absolutely. But I don't mean to discuss scientists. I'm just discussing scientific thought, right? I'm not talking scientists. Scientists, many of them are great scientists and very religious people as well. That's not my point. But science is focusing in on the veil of darkness and not seeing what's behind the veil. That's what science is. And that's what all studies of this world are, which is fine. It's very, you know, again, the Torah promotes understanding the world, something that we should understand the world. But you can never miss the fact that's only a veil of darkness over something much larger and greater, which is God's functioning behind this world.
Science deals with how, not doesn't deal with why.
Why? Good. That's a good way of putting it. Right. And we're supposed to understand the how, but also understand the why. You know, they have to come together. So science is just appreciating the outer layer of the world. And that's what ancient Greece appreciated, the externals. You know, that's why they would hold up the human body as something which was extremely important. You know, they had the Olympics and the nude. That's why architecture in ancient Greece was so significant, because they're looking at externals. And that's why science is looking at the externals of our world. And even philosophy is looking at externals of our world, because philosophy is only those things which the mind is able to pull out of viewing the world. Philosophy is, we're trying to determine everything based on what you see and what your mind understands, but you're not looking beyond. You're trying to totally exclude any supernatural explanations and base it totally on what you see in front of you. So that was ancient Greece. So they represent the darkness. This idea of darkness is this veil, this concealment over the world, which God put there on purpose so that we'd be able to have the choice to find God. They totally are obsessed, we'll say, are totally focused, are totally centered on that veil of darkness, but they don't look behind the darkness. They don't try to turn on the lights. They stay in the darkness. Now, the Torah would tell us that, well, we need to understand that veil of darkness, because that's how we can function in this world. That's how we can invent. That's how we can heal. That's how we can produce. I mean, that's something which is significant to do. The Torah does not discourage understanding of this world. However, the Torah makes us understand that what we're understanding there is just the veil of darkness, that this is merely the externals of the world. But there's an internal of the world. I mean, it's as if we were to say that if I went to describe a person to you, and I say, well, I see the skin, I see the eyes, I see the mouth, the teeth, the legs, the feet, the hands, but I ignore the person, because that's only the externals of the person. So you can even move on and describe the person's inner organs and heart and lungs. That's still not the person. We're not just organs, we're not just flesh, we're not just meat, but there is a mind, there's a personality, there's emotions, there's love, there's creativity, there's so much in a person that goes beyond the physical. And if I describe the world to you just based on the externals, I'm missing what's behind the externals. It's important to understand the person's externals. If you're a doctor, you have to understand the body. But if I want to say I want to describe to you the human being, I'm not just going to describe to you the externals, I need to describe to you the person. You know, people, unfortunately, who are very superficial, when they want to, let's say, make a date, so they might focus just on the looks. But we all know that that's not the human being you're trying to meet. You're trying to find a whole person. Looks might be significant, but you have to see the person. The person is beyond the looks. The person is the feelings and the emotions and the attitudes and everything else that goes along to a human being. So the world's the same way. The world has externals, which are significant. However, the world has something going on behind the scenes. Behind the scenes is the light. Behind the scenes is God, who runs the show, who makes the laws, who helps the world enter into to go in the proper direction. So appreciating externalities is important. But if you only appreciate externalities and you ignore the substance within, so then you're being misled. You can take another analogy. You go to the car dealership. So yeah, it's painted beautifully and it has leather seats. And it has the most modern, updated stereo system and all of these luxury, qualities to the car, but it doesn't drive. So you're missing the point. So you drive it out, and it dies 3 weeks later, and you're taking advantage of it because all you saw was the externals. You didn't see the internals, and it happens to be under the engine. That car was in terrible shape. So that we can't view the world just the externals, it's the internals as well. So Greece represents seeing the externals of this world. But we can't get lost in the externals. We can't lose the substance of it all. So this is the darkness. Now what's the light? The light is the Torah. When it says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. So like on this metaphoric level, what is that light? The light is the Torah itself. We say that near mitzvah Torah. It says in Proverbs that a mitzvah is like a candle, and Torah is the light. Because the wisdom of Torah, it's like flipping on the light switch. Helps us to see what's really behind the scene, what's really going on. Mitzvah is like a candle, and Torah is like light. That's what the verse says in Mishlei, in Proverbs. Because Torah tells us what's behind the mask. It uncovers the truth of the world. So this world is a world of helum, of concealment. And the Torah is light. It's interesting, in the Aramaic, the Torah is referred to as Oraisa, which is the same letters as Or, as light. It's considered called a word which is associated with light. The Torah was kept in the Aron, the Holy Ark. Aron is also the letters Aleph Vav Resh, of light, because the Torah is something which represents the light. So you have the darkness of Greece, and you have the light of the Torah, and they stand up against one another. Now, it's not a clash that the Torah has to destroy and defeat and make us ignore the wisdom of Greece, but Torah has to turn on the light to see this is the cover and this is the inside. You have to be aware of both. And Torah tells you what's truly happening behind the scenes. The more Torah we study, the more we understand the truth of the world. We know what's happening behind the scenes. We know that there's a God. That we know that God has a will. We know that God has desire for this world. And we know this world has a purpose. We know the human being has a soul. And we know that history functions based on God's plan. And we learn a lot more through Torah study. So a scientist just sees the outer layer. Someone who studies Torah sees what's behind the scenes as well. And they come together at a certain point. So when the Torah says, Vayihi Or, there was light, that light was a light of Torah, was the light of the true understanding of this world. Now that original light, Rashi told us, was hidden away for the righteous. So the Midrash tells us, where was that light hidden? Midrash says, God hid it in the Torah. This initial light, which was created, which was hidden away, God hid it inside the Torah, which means that if we study the Torah, we access this great light. So this light is the light of understanding, of perceiving the world from one end to the other, of understanding everything about the world. That's the light of the Torah. It's a very interesting reference made to Hanukkah in the Torah itself. Hanukkah is rabbinic. So Hanukkah was created, 2,000 years after the Torah was given. I mean, it's a rabbinic holiday, which was created during the times of the Second Temple. So we're talking about the year 200 BCE, something like that, 200 BCE, around there. Torah was given probably a good 1,500 years before that. But there are some allusions you find in the Torah to Hanukkah. So one that I always find fascinating is that Hanukkah is on the 25th day of the month of Kislev. That's tonight, the 25th of Kislev. The 25th word in the Torah is the word Or, is light. And you can count this Vayihi Or, that there was light, that is the 25th word of the Torah. And that itself is a very powerful reference to Hanukkah.
Um,
I mean, you can look at it yourself. It's a source. There is this, I can't tell you offhand. Yeah. Oh, you mean who points that out?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know who points that out. I've heard it before. I've heard it many times before. I'm sure it goes well before him. It could be he quotes it, but it's an older reference. You know, I'm sure it's, you know, he's very recent. But that reference tells us that, you know, the Hanukkah is all about the light, because Hanukkah is this clash of Greek culture and Greek wisdom versus Jewish culture and Jewish wisdom. That's what it is. Jewish wisdom is the wisdom of Torah. Greek wisdom is the wisdom of this world, of analyzing what's in the cover, in the veil. That's what it is. So the focus on Hanukkah becomes the menorah. Why is the focus on Hanukkah on the menorah? I mean, we know this, how the story goes. The Greeks, they defiled all the oil. The Jews then found that one pure vessel of oil and were able to light the menorah for 8 days. But it's interesting, like, why is the menorah the focus? I mean, it happens to be, it seems that the Greeks probably pillaged the entire temple at that point. And, I mean, I guess they were able to do the other services, I'm not really sure. But we do put a lot of emphasis on the menorah on Hanukkah. And our mitzvah is to light our own menorahs on Hanukkah. What's the idea of the menorah? So we know the menorah simply provides light. And we're discussing now the idea of light versus darkness. And when the Greeks came into the temple, whether they understood it or not, what they did is they were trying to darken that light. The light which we have, the light of Torah, which the menorah represents, they tried to darken it. The menorah itself represents, in the temple itself, we discussed this a few years back, you had three, basically the temple had two rooms. The back room was the Kodesh HaKadosh, the Holy of Holies. And the front room, which was called the Holy, the Heichal. That front room contained within it three vessels. You had in it the menorah, you had within it the golden altar, which they offered incense upon, and you had the shulchan, the table to show the lechem upon, the showbreads. Those were three different vessels in the inside that first room in the Beis HaMikdash. So the rabbis tell us that each one represents a certain idea, and the menorah represents the Torah itself. Why does the menorah represent the Torah? So as we said, Torah is light, and menorah provides light. The candles shine, and shine to us the light of Torah. The Talmud tells us, Harotzesh Yachkim Yadrim, if you want to become wiser, you should turn towards the south. Why the south? Because the menorah is situated in the south of the Beis HaMikdash. So it says if you want to become rich, you turn to the north, because that's where the table with the showbreads was. And that's the source of sustenance and food in this world. If you want to be wise, turn to the south, because in the south of the temple was the menorah, which represents the Torah itself. The Talmud also tells us that if you see oil in your dreams, you know, oil as the fuel used for the menorah, you should anticipate the light of the Torah. I mean, that's a good, it's a sign that you're going to be able to understand the Torah better. So the menorah represents the Torah itself. And the Greeks came in, they defiled the oils. They were trying to prevent us from lighting the menorah because essentially, deep down, they were out against the Torah. They didn't want Jews to, they couldn't stand for that, because they said everything has to be rational in our world, tested in a test tube, somehow analyzed through science or through math, with a formula and an equation. And the fact that there's another wisdom out there, which is true, but can't be tested in a test tube, and can't be put on display, and, you know, can't be put into a mathematical formula, that's something they couldn't stand for. Whether they knew what they were doing or not, that's not the point. There was a certain spiritual battle going on here as well. Yeah.
Are you saying the Greeks did not believe in God?
I said the Greeks believed in many gods, as we said, but the idea, you know, give me 1 second, I'll address your point. It's a good point. And the Greeks, what I'm saying sounds like the Greeks were atheists, and they weren't atheists. The Greeks had many, many pagan deities. They were pagans. They had many gods.
Well, to come to the conclusion that there is a god, one
god. The, who?
Plato.
Did he? I don't know. I'm not sure if he did. Aristotle, I think, was somewhat of a monotheist. That's the truth. Aristotle was somewhat of a monotheist. Not fully in the sense that we understand, but I think he was somewhat of a monotheist. I think the easy answer to your question is that, like I said before, the Greek gods were all gods which you could put into your own world. They were not some. We look at God as infinite, all powerful, cannot be limited, can't be attributed. You can't attribute to God any sort of human desires, human emotions. Greek gods, again, anyone who's read the Greek mythology, they were essentially human beings with problems and flaws and, you know, desires, and they were womanizers, and they themselves were hedonistic. Their gods were hedonistic, because they were able to take the idea of God and put it also into our world. You know, they didn't see God as something out of our world; it's not God within our world. So they believed in some form of a God, but their God was just human beings with superpowers.
Did you study Kant, the German philosopher?
No.
Because Kant came to the conclusion that God exists.
Okay. I'm not saying a philosopher can't come to that conclusion. I'm just saying that the trade of philosophy and science is something which kind of lends to avoiding God. That's all I'm pointing out. Yeah. The family of Hanukkah with Chashmonaim, the 25th stop in the desert was called Chashmonah. So another hint to Hanukkah there. Thank you. So the miracle of Hanukkah occurs with the menorah, because Hanukkah is all about the idea of the Torah, represented by the menorah, illuminating the truth to us. The miracle happens through Kohanim. Why are the Kohanim the heroes of our story? So again, historically, they're the ones who chose to rise up and fight against the Greeks. But on a deeper level, the Maharal points out that Kohanim are known as teachers of Torah. It says, Sifsei kon yishmeru das, the lips of the Kohen shall guard wisdom, but Torah shem yivach shem yifiyo, you should seek the words of Torah from the Kohen. So the Kohanim are known as teachers of Torah, and they were the ones able to stand up against the Greeks, because it was the power of Torah wisdom versus Greek wisdom. So as we perform a mitzvah tonight, we start tonight Hanukkah, light our candles, what should be our focus? You know, we're taking a fire, we're producing light. That's what we do when we light our menorah. Because the deeper understanding of Hanukkah is the battle of the Torah wisdom versus being fixated on science, on math, on the wisdom of our world. So as we light tonight, Hanukkah is a holiday which I find interesting in that it's in the middle of the winter, dead of the winter. But right now, in terms of the longest nights of the year, and this part of the year, because Hanukkah represents that we live in a world of darkness and concealment. You know, it's interesting, most mitzvahs, you have a few exceptions, most mitzvahs are not, they're daytime mitzvahs. You don't find many mitzvahs at night. You have a few, the seders at night. You have a few things that are at night, but you know, you can only blow shofar during the day. Lulav's only during the day. A bris meal can be done during the day. Tefillin's during the day. Talos is during the day. I mean, many mitzvahs are only during the day. But Hanukkah you do at night, and only at night. Because Hanukkah is the mitzvah which is supposed to light up the darkness. Hanukkah is supposed to see this world is a world of choshech al panei sehom. There's darkness in this world. There's a world of concealment and confusion, lack of perception, where God's not clear, the way the world functions is not clear. And it's a holiday where we sit here in exile, you know, without a temple, without the clarity which we had in the times of the temple, without prophecy. And we light fire. We light the light of the menorah. We light the light of the Torah, which shows us that we still have a way to understand this world despite all the darkness and confusion out there. That's our key. That's our ticket, our token, the way that we can understand this world is through the Torah. You know, as Jews, we survive based only on the Torah. Now, Hanukkah was the last holiday instituted by the rabbis, as if the Hanukkah was what they were giving us a gift. They're saying, this is the way you endure the exile. You know, after Hanukkah, even though the Jews won that battle, it wasn't an easy period for the Jews at that point. The leaders of the Jews eventually became Sadducees. They invited in Rome to settle their own disagreements. Rome took over the land of Israel. We were exiled. And ever since then, we've been roaming around the world and been persecuted and executed and, you know, chased in terrible times. That's where we are this very day. You know, it's a result of that. So the Hanukkah story did not end in any happy, rosy manner. But yet the rabbis say, I want you to take a lesson from this battle, which is that the way you'll survive all the darkness and confusion in the world you're about to go in, you're going to spend 2,000 years now in the exile, understand the Torah's way that you're going to survive it. The wisdom of the Torah is going to carry you through. As we say in the slichos of Yom Kippur, we say that the Ir HaKodesh, the holy city is destroyed, but in Lashon Rakha Torah, all we have left is the Torah. You know, the holy city is destroyed. We're outside of Israel. We have no holy temple. We don't have any prophecy. But what we do have is the Torah. The Torah is going to help us survive in the darkness. You know, we hope the darkness ends soon, and we're going to enter back into a world of light and clarity. But the way we survive darkness is through the Torah. So we light up the menorah in the dark of night, in the dark of winter, in the coldest parts of the year, and we show the world that as much darkness as you throw on us, we still can light it up through the Torah itself. I'll just add in one more point, just a more interesting reference, which is that the Jerusalem Talmud, Talmud Yerushalmi, tells us that this special light that we mentioned before, it was hidden away. How long did it last for before God hid it away? So Rashi doesn't tell us in the Chumash, but the Jerusalem Talmud says it lasted for 36 hours. Now, how many candles did we light on Hanukkah? If you add them all together.
How many
candles did we light on Hanukkah?
Maybe 45.
Well, it's 44, including the Shamash. But without the Shamash, it's 36. The Shamash makes it 44. But it's 36 candles. How many tractates are there of the Gemara? There's 36. Because 36 is a number, so this number tells us this is the number of the hidden lights, this is the number of candles of Hanukkah, this is the number of tractates of the Talmud. 36. 36.
1 plus 2 plus 3 and so on plus 8.
Yeah, plus 8, yeah.
36.
Yeah. Too high also. Yeah, another nice number. So it's all this reference that Hanukkah is a time we can access this hidden light of the Torah, which allows us to really understand the world, even in the worst of times, the most difficult of times, the darkest of times. After you light the candles, we say, we're not allowed to use the candles, so they're also unveiled, but just only gaze at the candles. So we should sit there and gaze at our candles and take in this message. How lucky we are that we have the ability to switch on the lights. In a dark world, we have the light switch. We can switch on the lights, we can see the light of the menorah, and that'll transport us back to the Holy Temple, help us understand the Torah itself, and know that no matter what we go through, we always have the Torah to help us understand the world.
Is it futile or not to see God in mathematics or in cosmology?
It's not futile, but the point is that, you know, a person can study cosmology or mathematics or biology or physics and be totally blown away by seeing God's wisdom. I mean, you can look at the world and find God's wisdom through everything. But it's all in the attitude. Someone who's looking for wisdom, you can look at the human body and you can be in awe of how perfect it is. And the design is just immaculate. But if you're a pure scientist and you're ignoring the idea of God, you see something which functions on its own, could have evolved this way, and, you know, has its own way, which is independent from God. So I think it's the opposite. I think that a Jew is supposed to know that there is a God who created the system, and then truly appreciate the system which we have. And the system is phenomenal. But you have to, we start with the foundation that there's a God who created it all.
Correct. In Torah, you'll find there's mathematics within the Torah. We just had the example of 36.
Right, true.
It's together.
It comes together, but the point is that your attitude has to be it's together.
Yeah.
The typical, you know, atheistic scientist out there, his idea is that I see everything can function on its own. Why do you have to think about God? The religious scientist says that I know there's a God in the world, and wow, I am in awe of his creations. And it can be the same exact equation, the same exact body, the same exact scientific law. But it's all in your attitude. It's all based on the attitude which is there.
I think science turns you more into a Hashem than ever before. Because the first time I looked at Google Earth during hurricane season, next hurricane season, look at Google Earth, that's not the hand of Hashem.
Right.
I think so. I plan on seeing it